Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I'm Chris Martinson. I am at the Casey Research Summit here in Tucson, Arizona in 2013, and I'm having the great privilege of talking with Bud Conrad. Are you chief economist at Casey?
Is that how you describe yourself? I am, and author of a book, Profiting from the World's Economic Crisis.
Profiting from the World's Economic Crisis, which great theme for this year. Doug Casey opened up this whole conference with a parallel to our situation in the United States with Rome. We saw some parallels with that. You had the honor of giving the first talk after Doug's. You had the first presentation, and you have bubble in the title. And part of your opening routine, we saw you blowing a big blue balloon, and it got bigger and bigger. And frankly, we were worried whether you were going to run out of air or not. That thing got bigger and bigger. It said bonds on it. And then what happened?
What happens to any bubble when you blow it up too big? Even if you're inside it and can't see it, you know what happens when it bursts. And of course, it went off with a bang. And I've had a lot of people come up and say, hey, that's a way to make it memorable, that we are about to have, and I might even say, beginning right now, a breaking of a bond bubble.
I've had a lot of people talk to me about, say, that was a very memorable part. So great, great part. I'm wondering how I could work that into my shtick, you know, something like that. But this bond bubble, you had a lot of great charts in there, and it's something that we've heard a lot about from many of the other presenters here. Jim Rickards was talking about, of course, QE is on everybody's minds. What is it that makes you say that bonds are in a bubble from your perspective?
The major one is the sort of inverse of the bond itself. The interest rates are at the lowest they have ever been. I mean, that includes the Depression. This is like a beach ball being pushed under the water, shall I say. Another analogy. We didn't have a swimming pool on stage, or I might have tried that one too. But you know what happens. If you push it down, it can kind of wiggle and squoggle for a while, and bam, when it pops up, it comes back with a vengeance. And that's why I think this, as an investment opportunity, perhaps is one of the biggest things that's really ever been this far distorted by, of course, our Federal Reserve buying up all the government debt, then buying up some of the mortgage-backed security debt, such that the buyers and sellers in the bond market have driven all interest rates down. Complicit with that is the advantage that banks get. With very low borrowing rates and moderately low but still higher other rates, the spread for banks is huge. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes called financial repression, and has destroyed the income of older folks' fixed income and given that largesse back to the banks. So in some sense, the Federal Reserve's policy have greatly benefited the large banks, and they've done it sort of by stealing from old folks.
Sort of. Not sort of. That's what they have done. It's been a great transfer of wealth, I've noted. You know, the $1 trillion plus in interest payments that were not paid to savers went to somebody, of course, and that went to the banks, because the whole thing was about repairing bank balance sheets, I think. Well, of course, you know, the Fed has a lot of clients out there. They present it as if the American people are their clients, but actually they've got a front line of clients who come first. That's the banks, the banking system. So they're really charged with making sure that's healthy and whole and all of that. And of course, they never say boo when the banks are out there making super record profits, doing some fairly shaky, maybe ill-advised things risky-wise. But still, they'll come back and say, oh, now everybody's got to help bail these poor people out, and we'll do some financial repression. And when you say bonds are high, at all-time highs, I was really shocked. This past year, we saw two things. We saw gilts in the UK, which is their version of a treasury bond, hit lows in interest rates that had not been seen in the 400-year series of those bonds. 400 years of wars and depressions and recessions and thises and thats, and never have they had an interest rate as low as they currently are. And the second thing was, in May of this year, was junk bonds hitting all-time lows. Triple C-rated bonds, never, never lower in all of their history. So when something's at an all-time high price, where are we?
Yeah, before we get to what's next, Chris, I want to get to a little bit about the other beneficiary of low interest rates. That's the government, who is the biggest debtor. They almost can't survive if rates were to get back to even natural levels. Government debt, $17 trillion, increasing $800 billion a year for 4 years gets you to $20 trillion. Nice round number. Let's pick 5% as a long-term time historical basis for what interest rates probably should be. And I think even you can do the math on that. $1 trillion a year of interest payment.
Let's see, what are total income tax receipts?
A little about $2.5 trillion round numbers. Mm-hmm. So it's almost, or getting there, to half the taxable income of the federal government.
Yep.
The point is, under normal circumstances, without this huge support from the Federal Reserve, our government is very close to bankrupt. And I would say it's easy to put a trajectory, just add a few more years onto that, of compounding that $1 trillion of interest, which then has to be borrowed, to the basis, to you saying you have a completely broke government and you discount that back to now, these rates should already be well above 5%.
Right, right. Who's buying a 30-year treasury at a little over 3%?
The Federal Reserve.
That's right. Who else could do that? You have to be economically insensitive to be buying at this rate, right? You have to be...
And before, there's two other components I want to get to what's going to happen. The first is, why are we in such a deficit? And there's two components to that. One is the forever wars. There is no justification or ability for our government to continue to pay roughly, I would say, $1.2 trillion for defense. It's officially $700 billion on the books of the Defense Department. There's a little other things like Veterans Affairs, Homeland Security, Black Ops, interest on the debt that's been accumulated because we've had the wars. My calculation is more like $1.2 trillion per year. And I would say that cost to our government is at the level where it hurts our economy and damages our strength as a nation more than the value and benefit we get from the military being one of the biggest in the world. It is, in fact, as big as all the other spending in the world, and it's feeding back on itself, being the military-industrial complex that cannot be denied. Every congressman says, oh, I'm not going to close this base in my neighborhood. I get that contract from my whatever it is, and it feeds on itself, and it is destroying our economy. The other piece of that, there's two, and you know this better than anybody, but I'm going to say the social programs, mm-hmm. when you have the retirement folks created by demographics of World War II, baby boomers, saying, look, I expect my Social Security and Medicare. They are out of control. But when 20% of the population is the number of people that are retired compared to the number of people working, moves to 35% over the next couple of decades, you have a huge demand on society, regardless of how you fund it. And it looks like it's $70 trillion for our discounted cash flow now to the present that we have no way to pay. So we have two ways to not have anything happen but the government to go bankrupt. And the question is, how do we fund this?
How do we fund this?
Which gets back to what a minute ago, when you asked, what happens to 30-year treasury? It's got to be bought by the Fed. And that means there is no exit policy. Yeah, they could taper for $10 billion a month somewhere. But I suspect the Fed is going to continue marching over the cliff of destroying our currency. And when people wake up to that, that's why interest rates must rise and why I suggest that people should invest in to protect themselves, maybe gain and prosper from the crisis, the fact that interest rates will rise. Quite different from many people who just say, oh, get out of safe bonds once you see you're losing a little money. The problem with that one is the kind of feedback loop you can have as an old-time retired investor looks at his quarterly income statement, says, gee, it went down. Why is that? Because I have this bond fund, whatever that is. I don't understand it. Didn't know you could lose money in bonds. Yeah, you can lose money. When rates rise, the bonds fall if they're any long duration. When people find that they're losing money, they say, I don't want these bonds. You sell them. And then the question is, to who? To whom? The Fed is the only answer, so they can't taper. But where does that lead us to? Worldwide destruction of currencies, often called currency wars. So that's the backside of the bursting of the bubble. And I go one step further. We are in that bursting now because interest rates, instead of falling during the last year's biggest rate of QE, $1 trillion a year, $85 billion a month, Treasuries and MBS, that rate rose. It didn't fall this year. Mm-hmm. This year, 2013, you could. I do have a chart. I love to do it. I'm waving my hand around here. I wish I had something gonna. But the chart is, as the Federal Reserve increased its purchases and increased its balance sheet, rates tended to go exactly the opposite direction.
Of course.
Because they're driving them down. They're driving the price of bonds up as they buy them. This year, it went the other way. Now, is that just a fluke? Or is this it? My claim is this is it. Mm-hmm. We've already passed the bottom in rates. I am not predicting cataclysmic rise yet, but we have talked here, and maybe you can explain why things, when they start to move, keep going. What happens if the Fed says, well, we'd like to get back to normal, let's sell off some of our assets?
Well, this is where the Fed gets into trouble. So we've heard a lot at this conference about how QE is a permanent program now. There's maybe some social reasons that people hate to admit they're wrong, and maybe the Fed would have to admit they're wrong a little bit. There might be political reasons that the federal government's in some sort of gridlock, and maybe they're going to violate a debt ceiling, and they've got all sorts of deficits they have to spend, and so the Fed's now wedded to whatever policy that is and has promised them the federal government to help take care of it there. But there's a technical reason, which is that the Fed has been there buying bonds with the intention of driving down interest rates, right? That's the easing part of the quantitative easing statement. And with that, with those lower interest rates, they wanted to see things like more auto loans, more student loans, more housing loans, including a rise in house prices, because that's what the Fed's been targeting all along, is to get more people borrowing more money. And so they're going to claim a little success. Look, the housing market is back. Of course, that might be mostly large private equity firms buying huge swaths of distressed real estate off of bank balance sheets. But the Fed's been spending trillions to get interest rates down to where they are. And what you noted, what happened this year in 2013, that is certainly noteworthy, we should have at least one eye half open looking at it, is that even with the Fed continuing that program, interest rates went the wrong direction. And not just a little bit, but a lot. Over 100 basis points on the 10-year. And it did it very rapidly, right?
Doubling the rate, 1.5 to 3%.
Doubling.
Doubling.
That's amazing.
And which, that's, in an inversion, you know, you can take a number and turn it upside down, is a big change in the price of the bond.
Yep.
I just had to interrupt.
Well, thank you. And so you've, Your views, this was welcome or unwelcome news by the Fed?
I think the Fed knows more than it tells us it knows, because they can't really be that stupid. But they don't know everything, and it seems like they don't want to defend the basic job that they're supposed to do, the dollar. They're willing to give that up in favor of short-term economic stimulus. I guess one other piece that's part of my talk that I want to throw out, and since I'm getting down to the end, I think, here. But Doug Casey talked about the decline of the Roman Empire. In our own situation, we are an empire that I think is weakening, not crashing. But would you want to be confident in the creditworthiness of the U.S. government this year as much as you would have 20 years ago? Obviously not. And that's my point about why rates are really underpricing the risk going forward. And I think the listeners have their own reasons for being concerned about whether our government is strong and should be invested in, that they can maybe take ideas back from on the costs of forever wars, the cost of entitlements, the costs of surveillance, just the plain old corruption of the best government money can buy. There's many reasons to be critical. I don't have to cover them all, but I think it's another set of important long-term reasons to be concerned and pretty confident that we're not going back to the kind of lows we had even 6 months ago.
Interesting. So a lot of what you talked about so far is that there are structural reasons that the United States is, if not going to end with a bang, is certainly whimpering at this point in time. We've got military spending that is just structurally way too high. Technically, it should be peacetime. We're not really technically at war with anybody at this point in time. Of course, we're fighting wars all over the place. And we've got a structural issue with the entitlement programs. And then soon enough, when interest rates rise, we're going to have a structural problem with interest payments alone as a portion of the federal budget. And with all of that, that leaves the Fed at least locked into trying to perpetuate that paradigm. But the Fed, if I'm going to back up 4 or 5 years, I'm sure they were peering into this part of the future and imagining that right now we'd be in robust growth again, that they were thinking they could help us through a cyclical downturn, get us back into a nice cyclical period of growth, but it's structural. They've run into something I don't think the Fed truly appreciated or understood. It's clear they didn't understand how bad the housing bubble was going to be. They didn't really understand financial markets. I don't think they understood what shadow banking was really up to and how profound it really was. And with all of that, I think they are missing something at this point, which is you can't solve a problem rooted in too much debt with more debt, but they're trying, right? Bless their hearts. And
that's a good one.
And you can't solve a problem that's rooted in insolvency with more liquidity, because that's really what they're doing. They've helped to make some of the big banks solvent, I believe, by taking dodgy assets off of their books, and also through regulations and encouragement, allowing us to go to these mark-to-fantasy balance sheets rather than mark-to-market, which is still part of the banks. You know, people say, oh, look at J.P. Morgan's earnings. Oh, they took a $3 billion charge. I don't think that's the half of it. I don't know what's on their books. I've looked at their 10-Qs. I can't make sense of them. They're not marking anything to market. They have these huge 200-page, you know, annual reports or whatnot for J.P. Morgan. And then the part you care about most is a paragraph, a footnote that says, at management's discretion, we've just decided to value things at what we think makes a lot of sense. I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty close, right? And so the Fed's the enabler of all of that. And I'm sure that at this point in time, they were expecting very different results. And they're not getting it. When we look at the labor force participation rate, when we look at the kinds of jobs that have been created up to this point in time, when we look at the number of people who are on food stamps, we look at where the money is actually going and seeing the growing wealth inequity, which happens, right? Isn't that just a feature of when you print and dump money into a market? Isn't it by definition true that those closest to the money make the most gains from that? Guess what? Those are all the big firms. Guess what? They're doing great. Everybody else, not so much. I mean, this is all perfectly understandable and predictable. And given that, now would be a good time, I think, to step back and go, wasn't working. But is the Fed going to do that?
Well, we've been saying for years the Fed is between a rock and a hard place, meaning whether they defend the dollar or try and improve the economy by creating more debt, doing the things they're doing. And they're not going to try and defend the dollar, is my point out of that. People often ask me, well, Bud, when? I say, well, I'm not sure when, but I want to at least point out one additional problem, which is that we have a huge derivatives market of $600 trillion, $400 trillion of which are interest rate related derivatives. People sort of forget that the housing bubble started in the CDOs on the subprime market in that derivatives bubble. Mm-hmm. I am sure there's not just one, but maybe 10 disasters to occur when rates move dramatically. You could have it be a disaster if rates could go lower. Mm-hmm. They can't. This was the mechanism by which the large banking system transmitted the low rates to the Federal Reserve throughout the whole system. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the decline in rates in the high yield market from, for a really weak bond, 40% down to 10%. It's pretty dramatic, the lowest ever. They do that because they give a swap. We'll take your floating rate because you can't even get a fixed rate. We'll give you a fixed rate at a much lower level, give you liquidity because we can borrow it for nothing. Mm-hmm. They transmit it throughout the whole market. And as long as the Fed keeps its rate at zero, that's a moneymaker for the swaps derivatives issuer in this case. The banks get hugely rich. But if the interest rate moves the other way, then there is a self-feedback of crash around it. I think that's also likely, although I can't predict when, but it's sort of like impossible between now and the crash that destroys the dollar, that the probable trigger is buried in that $600 trillion, a number you're hard to think of when our own GDP is $15 trillion. The ratios are mind-boggling, numbing, more difficult to absorb than the two-inch-thick J.P. Morgan annual report you were just talking about.
Absolutely. You know, I was talking with somebody who's actually in the derivatives market, and I'm very critical of what derivatives might bring us at some point in time. And his point to me was, he's like, look, these things work perfectly. They work all the time. I see it happen. The junk companies go out, the credit default swap gets triggered, and it gets paid. He said that they're working like they're supposed to. And I said, that's fine. If you know, they are insurance in a market that doesn't really need insurance. But the whole market collectively is using them as insurance for something that, if the whole market turns, it will completely make the entire insurance pool go bust, right? So
it becomes from whom? Where do you get the money to pay those derivatives if they all collapse? Obviously, there is no creation of wealth in any of this that's going to back it up.
Yeah.
They are unregulated due to the Federal Reserve's position that if they regulated them, they'd probably find something wrong and cause a crash, I think. The maestro didn't say that when he said there's no need to regulate. They are self-regulating because if there were a problem, they would crash and then somebody would never do that again. That's the kind of Greenspan double talk that didn't make sense.
Yep.
That just like don't your bond, your trader guy had just said, oh, these CDOs work in small amounts. They work. But in aggregate, you and I can just sort of measure and say you can't have these kind of rates, a huge change and not major disruption. I'm sure there is a major destruction. I said destruction, but I meant disruption.
Yep.
And hard to say the difference here. Sometime in our future. In other words, the country is now bankrupt. If the country is now bankrupt, why would you want to hold its bonds?
I guess because you have no other choice. That's how some people feel about it. I don't know what I would do if I was in a pension fund fiduciary responsibility sort of position, or if I was in an endowment. Were you actually, like, what would you do? We've been hearing a lot about Detroit and its insolvent pension fund and all of that. But if you're the fiduciary for that pension fund, and you're still looking out across this landscape, and by the way, they are forbidden from investing in certain things, like potentially gold or something like that. And so they have to be in a universe of stocks and bonds in order to meet their fiduciary responsibilities, not be sued, not even go to jail potentially. So they have to be in this market, and they have to buy bonds. And you scan across this thing, you're like, well, I'll take these junk bonds at 6%. I'll take a 30-year at 3%. What do you do? I don't know what you do in that point in time. I really don't.
Tick, 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 tick. Chris, you know as well as I, those guys that are, quote, fiduciary responsibility, are waking a paycheck. They don't do want to do anything that'll get them fired.
Mm-hmm.
It's not their money. They don't really care the way I think you've thought this through and many of the people at this conference about the fundamental structural imbalances of not, by the way, just the U.S. It's just about as bad in Europe, and I think it's worse in Japan. You add to it a Bank of England and a whole country that has a debt-to-GDP ratio more like 600% in England. Ours is like 350%. The world has just thought that they can squeeze the golden egg goose out of golden eggs, make themselves rich first, that is the bankers and the governments and the people closely allied with them, military-industrial complex, at the expense of everybody else, and not hurt the whole system. The goose is going to be killed by the structure of the tracks that this is on right now. Sell your bonds, profit from selling short bonds, and at least hide anything that could be grabbed as an asset by the government in paper form in something more solid. And that's, in my view, gold. It's probably things like real estate in the long term, although that's damaging in a high interest rate market. It may be a whole lot of different ways to think about what wealth is that isn't something that is a bunch of zeros on a digital entry in a computer that isn't worth the paper it's not printed on.
Very well said. So if we can't exactly say when, because nobody can say when, let's talk about the how. What are you looking at as to what are your indicators to know that we might be turning into another phase of this, or if the, you know, when this, how will you know that the bond bubble's bursting? You said you've been watching very carefully the rise in interest rates, maybe the 10-year is your preferred indicator. But what should we really be looking at here?
All the things we've been looking at today in this discussion are part of it. But
interest rates, looking across the whole credit structure. So we'd look at interest rates on junk bonds to AAAs, you're saying. And what else?
Yeah. One of the speakers here, Nick Graziano, came up to me afterwards, and he'd shown a large number of technical indicators on charts.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of laughed because one of the guys that was in the audience asked me about one of the government numbers. And is this real? And is this the right inflation rate? Can you tell me what the real definition of money supply is? What is the money supply growth? And we were sort of having an intellectual debate. and Nick sort of leans back and sort of laughs. He says, you know, we get a price out of this stock market every day. We know what it is. They don't have to revise that with the latest GDP revision upgrade of unemployment rate. What is the unemployed? What is all these things? He says, look, I look at this thing, and is it going up or going down? In the market we're talking about, watch the interest rate itself. It is not revised by the government. Mm-hmm. Somebody is paying whatever it is. Market clears it. It's already turned. Mm-hmm. So I think we're into it. We'll see. The big picture economic indicators are, what's the best word? Unreliable. I think the stock market is a good measure of the health of the economy, and interest rate is a very good measure of the direction and health of the bond market, which I am now claiming is going in for a 10 or 20-year collapse.
Wow, and there are ways to play that, of course. You can play the inverse of the bond funds, what advice would you give, like let's say somebody's got a typical portfolio, they've got stocks and they've got bonds. If you saw something, like here's what would make my hair catch on fire. If all of a sudden I saw the 10-year vaulting up by 10, 15, 20, 30 basis points at a clip, you know, in a day, and it really was running for a different territory, that would be a point where I would tell people, you got to protect yourself. This would be a time to get insurance on your portfolio, go neutral to the market, maybe go inverse, something like that. Would you agree with that, or is there some other way to position yourself here?
Let me say, you might not think about a portfolio allocation as a way to think about investing. I think that's a crutch for a young kid who doesn't know what to recommend to a client. We'll put some in real estate. We'll put some in structured laddered munis. We'll put some in high-flying tech. And I'm sure you'd like to have this fund over here that's good for the environment. A little of everything, and the guy makes his commission, and who cares? I say just about the opposite. Steve Jobs grew up in the house across the street from mm-hmm. where I raised my kids. He said, there's a common saying, you shouldn't put all your eggs in one basket. He said, put all your eggs in one basket and watch it very closely. Mm-hmm. In that light, if you really believe my scenario, you go out and mortgage your house to the hilt. You borrow. You don't just own bonds in your portfolio. You become short by borrowing. And go buy stuff. A leveraged gold investment in the futures market is much more likely to return an income than anything you have in a bank account. Mm-hmm. Now, that isn't advice that I give lightly mm-hmm. to moms and pops who say, I want to look at my statement once a year. and anybody who's traded futures will know that about 90% of the people that trade them lose. Mm-hmm. What that means, of course, is if you're the 10% who watched your basket very closely, you can prevail very positively. But it's a hard game, and unless you're willing to really work at it to become the guy who watches the eggs closely, you can lose your shirt. But my basic point of view is this idea of protection, sell off your bonds, is inadequate. Mm.
Right. Right. I've talked to a lot of people who manage money. There are several here at this conference and elsewhere in my life. And there's a sense of resignation now, which boils down to don't fight the Fed, right? It's the oldest statement in the book. And so there is this sense of resignation that somehow the system is going to keep doing what it does. And that if you run up against that, you're just going to get killed. And so really what it boils down to, I know that there's almost like paralysis from novice to sophisticated investors alike, don't really know what to do anymore, which just underscores that the main point, which I think came out in your talk and several others I saw, which is these are not ordinary times. These are extraordinary times. Keep a journal. We're in the middle of one of the most amazing monetary experiments in all of history. So if it's a little confusing, that's okay. Because it's wildly confusing, because I believe nobody has any idea exactly what's happening right now. And that includes the Fed, which gives me a little bit of comfort and a lot more fear. Right? And there's a reason to be concerned, because the Fed is playing with something it has no clue about, which is they're playing with the trust a society has within and among itself. That's what money is to me. It's an article of trust. And they're saying, we're going to erode trust. Of course, they target monetary stuff and tell you it's all scientific, and they've got Taylor rules and other monetary rules. But what they're really doing is they're eroding your and my trust between and with each other in the markets, and hoping that they can erode it just enough so that you and I will take our wallets out and spend just fast enough to give them just the inflation rate they want. But these feedback mechanisms that have been sort of coming through our conversation, I think, are the important ones here, because once that genie gets out of the bottle, history says it's out. And who knows what happens next. But boy, the opportunity for wealth destruction and transfers in this next period of time, I think are as high as you could possibly find in history.
I'll start by agreeing, that this time is not a normal four-year business cycle recession.
All right.
But what's happening is not that unusual. It happens all the time. By all the time, I mean 100 currency regimes have been destroyed in the last 100 years. Across the major countries, it's about once a generation. One of the things I did in the talk was showed the value of the Argentine peso from 1950 to now.
Oh, great graph on that one.
And it was a little hard to look at as a graph because it was log scale with lines going across it for every 10 multiple of loss in purchasing power. And there's 12 of them, which turns out to be a trillion revisions. So that if you had had 12 trillion pesos in 1950, your purchasing power today would be one peso.
Imagine that. You were a trillionaire in Argentina.
Got a bad knock on the head,
woke up, and you have a...
there never was a trillion pesos, just to put a little perspective. The country never had that many at any point. It's only a mechanical calculation on the destruction and reissue of new currency, which is fairly regular. My point of this is there's plenty of models that say where the U.S. is, debt to GDP ratios, are right now over the cliff of Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff's very popular book, 90% GDP, debt to GDP is when risks get very high of collapse. We're on the track of. This is very predictable. It's not that unusual. We are going to have a currency collapse. In fact, my assertion, people make different ones. Mike Maloney's got his. His is a decade. Mine is that in my lifetime, we will see the destruction of our currency and a reissue of new currency. And for Americans, that's a big deal. Ours is the second oldest currency in the world. But for Argentinians, they send the money to Switzerland. They send the money to the U.S. And in fact, the numbers I just gave you, the $12 trillion, was based on the dollar, which lost about a factor of 40 over that time frame, measured in gold. So if you were to say your $1 trillion, then divide that, gave you one peso in purchasing power in gold, divide it by another 40. If you had 1 ounce of gold denominated in pesos, it would now be one... Never mind.
I know where you're going with
anyway,
that.
Anyway, the point of it is, it isn't... Maybe some Federal Reserve people are acting like they don't know what's going on, but it's available. The world has told us we're going on to destruction of our dollar.
And that's a pretty big deal, and that's what we're in the middle of. So, Bud Conrad, Chief Economist, Casey Research, thank you so much for your time today. And I just want everybody to know that the room is actually in color. It's not in black and white right now. It's a beautiful day here, and what I love is that there's a lot of optimism still about how, as individuals, if we can see all of this coming, that we can navigate our own course and find a way. But aggregate, oh boy, this is going to be going to be a doozy, isn't it?
Chris, you and I have something in common that I didn't know was going to be so at this conference. Both of us concluded our talks with, let's look around the world and see what's going on. You just did here with the room, and yeah, there's some sunshine outside. Well, I'll say my own first. I looked at people after this doom and gloom we just went through and said, hey, look, there are things in the world that are important to us. This is mine. Mm-hmm. And I showed my family. You did something like that at the end of yours. You said, this is my community. Yep. It was your family and your environment and friends out having a wonderful time, I think, growing things in the wonderful summer is that Massachusetts, I think?
Yep, that's right.
And I think all of us need to somehow get out of, at least I, green eye shade, worrier, doom and gloomer, once in a while go get out on my sailboat, go grow things in your garden, have some fresh tomatoes that are fresher than you ever get in a store, and enjoy the life we do have, recognizing what's going on and prevailing against it in some sense.
Well, and that's the great, there was a quote that somebody put up, which I believe was F. Scott Fitzgerald, which is, the mark of an intelligent mind is to be able to hold two opposing views without going insane. And so... what we have to do is hold where the world really is, and that's a pretty interesting point of view to hold, and then also live our lives fully and completely, and noting the sun comes up, and focusing on what's really important to us. So this is tricky business to really pay attention to where the world's going and just live your life as fully and as happily as possible. I believe that that's why there's so many intelligent people here and who are not insane. So with that, I want to thank you for your time today.
Great time. Always good talking to you, Chris.